ABC right here on VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Coming up on the program, Mario Ritter Jr. has a story on how American presidents spend the 4th of July holiday. Ashley Thompson has this week's health and lifestyle report on vaccines used as cancer treatments. Later, we listen to the next part in our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
Americans celebrate Independence Day on the 4th of July. American presidents have their own ways of celebrating the holiday, too, with or without the public. Many presidents have gone to the beach, the mountains, farms, or golf courses for the national holiday. During the Depression, President Franklin Roosevelt even went sailing to Hawaii on a fishing and working vacation. July 4th has also been a day for some presidents to be at the center of the celebration with the public. This year, U.S. President Joe Biden plans to invite members of the military, veterans, and their families to the White House for an outdoor cookout and holiday celebration. 2 years earlier, Biden told a crowd at the White House that we're closer than ever to declaring our independence from a deadly virus. It was the first large event for Biden, who took office during the COVID-19 pandemic. In 2017, President Donald Trump played golf and then celebrated with military families at the White House. President Barack Obama combined two 4th of July traditions, celebrating American troops and honoring new citizens in 2012. Like several presidents before him, President George W. Bush welcomed more than 70 new citizens from 30 countries at a White House ceremony in 2008. In 1987, President Ronald Reagan used the holiday as a chance to talk about his economic program in a holiday radio message. As the United States turned 200 years old in 1976, President Gerald Ford spoke at Independence Hall in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, where the nation's founders approved the Declaration of Independence. Later, he watched a show of tall sailing ships in New York Harbor. For President Dwight D. Eisenhower, it was time for golf and more golf in 1953 and 1957. With World War II ending the year before, President Harry Truman enjoyed the 1946 holiday in Maryland's Catoctin Mountains, now known as Camp David. In 1930, President Herbert Hoover spent time by the Rapidan River in the state of Virginia. And in 1928, President Calvin Coolidge, who was born on July 4th, 1872, went trout fishing in Wisconsin. During the Civil War, President Abraham Lincoln used the holiday to ask Congress for more troops to fight the South in 1861. In 1850, President Zachary Taylor became ill after eating and drinking on the holiday. He died 5 days later. President James Monroe, who was the nation's fifth president, died on July 4, 1831, in New York City, at age 73. In addition to Monroe, two other former presidents died on Independence Day. John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, who had been political enemies but friends in later private life, both died on the 4th of July, 1826, hours apart. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
Big development in cancer treatment could be a vaccine. After years of limited success of vaccines to treat cancer, scientists say research has made many advancements. Many doctors predict more vaccines will be out in 5 years. They are not traditional vaccines that prevent disease. Instead, they are shots to shrink tumors and stop the cancer from coming back. Targets for these experimental treatments include breast and lung cancer. There were also gains reported this year for the deadly skin cancer melanoma and for pancreatic cancer. Dr. James Gulley helps lead a center at the U.S. National Cancer Institute that develops immune treatments, including cancer treatment vaccines. We are getting something to work. Now we need to get it to work better, he said. More than ever, scientists understand how cancer hides from the body's immune system. Cancer vaccines, like other immune system treatments, strengthen the immune system to find and kill cancer cells. Some new cancer vaccines use mRNA, which was developed for cancer but was first used for COVID-19 vaccines. For a vaccine to work, it needs to teach the immune system's T cells to recognize cancer as dangerous, said Dr. Nora Desis. She is with the University of Washington Medicine's Cancer Vaccine Institute in Seattle. Once trained, T cells can travel anywhere in the body to hunt down danger, she said. Patient volunteers are very important to the research. 50-year-old Kathleen Jade learned she had breast cancer in late February. She waited on a hospital bed for her third dose of an experimental vaccine. She is getting the vaccine to see if it will shrink her tumor before surgery. Even if that chance is a little bit, I feel like it's worth it, Jade said. Progress on treatment vaccines has been difficult. The first such vaccine, Provenge, was approved in the U.S. in 2010 to treat prostate cancer. It requires processing a patient's own immune cells in a lab and returning them through the veins. There are also treatment vaccines for early bladder cancer and advanced melanoma. Early cancer vaccine research had difficulties. The cancer would outfight patients' weak immune systems, said Olya Finn. She is a vaccine researcher at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. All of these trials that failed allowed us to learn so much, Finn said. Finn's research is now centered on patients whose cancers were caught early. That is because the experimental vaccines did not help with more advanced patients. Finn's group is planning a vaccine study in women with a low-risk form of breast cancer. More vaccines that prevent cancer may be coming. Decades-old hepatitis B vaccines prevent liver cancer. HPV vaccines, introduced in 2006, prevent cervical cancer. People with the condition Lynch syndrome have a 60% to 80% lifetime risk of developing cancer. Getting them to take part in cancer vaccine trials has been easy, said Dr. Eduardo Villar Sanchez of MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas. He is leading two government-supported studies on vaccines for Lynch-related cancers. Drug producers Moderna and Merck are developing a personalized mRNA vaccine for patients with melanoma. The vaccines are designed for each patient based on the many differences in their cancer tissue. A personalized vaccine can train the immune system to hunt for the cancer's mutation and kill those cells. The vaccines under development at the University of Washington are designed to work for many patients. Tests are ongoing in early and advanced breast cancer, lung cancer, and ovarian cancer. Some results may come as soon as next year. Jamie Crace was one of the first people to receive the ovarian cancer vaccine. She got the vaccine during a safety study 11 years ago. Crace was diagnosed with advanced ovarian cancer at the age of 34. She thought she would die young. Now she is 50, with no sign of cancer. She does not know for sure if the vaccine helped. But she said, "I'm still here." I'm Ashley Thompson.
Ashley joins me now to talk more about this week's health and lifestyle report. Hi, Ashley.
Hi, Dan.
Today's report was about recent advancements in the development of cancer treatment vaccines. Researchers note that some of these vaccines are more successful in patients with early stages of cancer as opposed to those with more advanced stages of disease. I was wondering if you could first explain how the root word advance means two different things here.
Sure. When talking about advancements or advances in cancer treatment vaccine research, the word means the process of making something better or more successful. It means the same thing as progress. But when we say someone has an advanced form of a disease, the meaning is much less positive. The adjective advanced in this case, means the disease has reached a very bad or serious state. The patient is sicker. Advanced cancers are much more difficult to treat than early stage cancers.
But the adjective advanced does have many other meanings too, right?
For sure. It can have a positive meaning too. For example, I'm sure we have many advanced English learners listening to our program today. In this example, advanced means beyond the basic level.
Thanks for those explanations, Ashley.
You're welcome. Thank you, Dan.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation. American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue the story of the presidency of George W. Bush. Bush began his second term and fifth year in office in January 2005. Early in his first term, terrorists had carried out the worst attacks in United States history. President Bush declared a war on terror and led the country into wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. In his second inaugural address, he promised to continue fighting to defeat terrorism and increase democracy around the world.
So it is the policy of the United States to seek and support the growth of democratic movements and institutions in every nation and culture with the ultimate goal of ending tyranny in our world.
He also talked about his goals at home and what he called America's ideal of freedom.
In America's ideal of freedom, citizens find the dignity and security of economic independence instead of laboring on the edge of subsistence. This is the broader definition of liberty that motivated the Homestead Act, the Social Security Act, and the GI Bill of Rights. We will widen the ownership of homes and businesses, retirement savings, and health insurance, preparing our people for the challenges of life in a free society by making every citizen an agent of his or her own destiny. We will give our fellow Americans greater freedom from want and fear and make our society more prosperous and just and equal.
The United States Constitution limits presidents to two terms. Presidential historian Russell Riley at the University of Virginia's Miller Center says presidents traditionally use their first term to focus on their major goals for the country. Second terms, he says, tend to be unhappy times. During his second term, Richard Nixon resigned over the attempt to hide political wrongdoing in the Watergate case. Bill Clinton faced a trial in the Senate over his attempt to hide a relationship with a young aide. But the first major problem of George Bush's second term dropped from the sky.
You saw people on the rooftops. You saw people using claw hammers trying to break through their attic to get up onto the roof. That's why you had so many people who drowned.
In August of 2005, Susan Bennett received a phone call from her daughter, a television reporter in New Orleans, Louisiana.
She called on a Friday and said, "I think you need to come and pick up my son because there's a really big storm coming."
It was Hurricane Katrina, one of the worst natural disasters in American history. Along the Gulf of Mexico, the hardest hit states were Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. Over 1,800 people died. Property damage totaled more than $75 billion. But Katrina will be remembered mostly because of what happened in New Orleans.
It has gutted the hotel!
A day before the storm hit, officials had ordered everyone to leave the city. But thousands of people stayed. Some chose not to leave. Others were too poor, too old, or too sick to go. Then the levees broke. Those flood barriers were supposed to protect the city. Much of New Orleans was built on land that lies below sea level. As Katrina hit, more than 80% of the city flooded. In some areas, the water was 6 meters deep. Many people who stayed were caught in the floods. Officials struggled to get food, water, and medicine to the survivors. The displaced included thousands of people who took shelter in the Superdome, a big sports arena. Out on the streets, lawless acts fed a sense of disorder and helplessness.
It's disgusting and frustrating. And we are human beings, and they're treating us like we're criminals.
Susan Bennett helped create an exhibit about Hurricane Katrina at the Newseum, a museum of news in Washington.
Not only in this country, but also in newspapers across the world, you saw the same headline. It ranged from engulfed to our tsunami, chaos, and then it went to anarchy, national disgrace.
Congress later found that officials at every level of government, local, state, and federal, had failed in doing their jobs. President Bush flew over New Orleans to inspect the damage. A photograph showed him looking out the window of Air Force One at the ground below. Russell Riley at the University of Virginia says the picture expressed what many people were thinking about the handling of the disaster.
Because of the ineffectiveness of the government response at the time, that image communicated to the American people that the president was remote, that he wasn't on the ground, that the best he could do was just look out the window of a passing plane.
In 2005, a different kind of storm was hitting Iraq. American and Iraqi officials were struggling to create a democratic government. Local militias were on the rise and attacking coalition forces and other Iraqis. The violence also included Al-Qaeda suicide bombings in Iraq, which angered many Iraqis. And there was international anger as the result of photos that showed American troops abusing Iraqi prisoners. President Bush had declared the end of major combat operations on May 1st, 2003. That was less than 2 months after the invasion. But the numbers of civilian and military deaths were growing. And in the United States, surveys were showing that a growing number of Americans thought going into Iraq was a mistake.
The bad news was we were uncomfortable with it, and we wanted to get out, and we could not understand how things could go so terribly wrong.
Judith Yaffe joined the National Defense University after 20 years as a Middle East expert at the Central Intelligence Agency.
That's where the lack of strategy and the mismanagement come in. But I think it's also true that, you know, Americans just wanted to say, why are we in Iraq? Why are we in any of these places? Because historically speaking, it's not a role we've been comfortable with.
She says by President Bush's second term, few Iraqis wanted to cooperate with the Americans to make the country more secure. But President Bush said American troops could not leave until Iraqi forces replaced them. In 2006, an Iraqi court sentenced the country's former leader to death. Saddam Hussein was hanged for crimes against humanity. But nothing else seemed to change. Violence and insurgent attacks continued. Iraq seemed to be on the edge of being torn apart by civil war. Early the next year, President Bush announced that he was sending more troops to Iraq. He thought it would help stop the violence.
These troops will work alongside Iraqi units and be embedded in their formations. Our troops will have a well-defined mission to help Iraqis clear and secure neighborhoods, to help them protect the local population, and to help ensure that the Iraqi forces left behind are capable of providing the security that Baghdad needs.
The temporary increase of about 30,000 troops came to be called the surge. In September of 2007, the top commander in Iraq reported to Congress that the violence was decreasing. The surge may have helped create the conditions for this change, but there were other reasons as well. Middle East expert Judith Yaffe says many Iraqis decided to work with the Americans to defeat the insurgency.
The real truth is, and it's a good news story, that the Iraqis themselves saw that this was a greater danger to them, that there was nothing to be gained. The Sunnis of Iraq in particular saw that Al-Qaeda was hurting them, that it was a danger to them, that there was much more to be gained by aligning with the U.S. forces.
By the time President Bush was finishing his second term, Iraqi and American officials had agreed on a withdrawal date to end the war. The last American forces would leave Iraq by the end of 2011. Russell Riley at the University of Virginia says it is too soon to know how history will judge the United States' actions in Iraq.
If Iraq proves to be a policy success, then the surge will be a critical turning point and a terrific exercise of presidential leadership.
He also points out that the war is not the only measure by which the 43rd president will be judged. Professor Riley put it this way: the great debate among historians will not be whether Bush was a powerful president or a consequential president, but whether he directed those powers in the most fruitful way that he could have. So what else was going on in the United States during this period? Millions of people were voting for which singer should get a recording contract on American Idol. Year after year, it was the most popular show on television.
Oh, Robert, I think you just killed my favorite song of all time.
Killed in a good way or a bad way?
I'm afraid. Well, listen, killing is never good.
Killing is never good.
There's never a happy killing.
I'm sorry to hear that.
No, I mean, that was first degree on that.
But the biggest story in music was not what people were listening to, but how. Sales of CDs in stores fell as more and more people downloaded songs from the internet. On iTunes, Fergie's Big Girls Don't Cry was the most downloaded song of 2007. For the first half of the decade, there seemed to be nothing to cry about in the American housing market. Home prices were going up and up, which made sellers happy. And lenders were offering bigger and bigger loans at easy terms and low interest rates, which made buyers happy. The government supported the easing of lending rules as a form of social policy, a way to help more people buy homes. Rates of home ownership, a part of the American dream, reached record highs. In 2005, nearly 7 out of 10 Americans owned their own home. But many home buyers had been given mortgage loans that they could not afford to pay back. And that was not the only problem. Banks had been selling those loans as securities to investors around the world. Everyone thought they were getting a good deal. The banks, the borrowers, the investors. But then the price bubble burst and the housing market collapsed. Many borrowers lost their homes because they were unable to make their monthly loan payments. That was the situation Karen Lucas and her husband of Cleveland, Ohio, found themselves in.
I've done my crying. I've made my peace, and I put it in God's hands.
As home values fell, many people found themselves underwater, meaning they owed more on their mortgage than their house was worth. Suddenly, there was a lot to cry about. By the end of 2007, the economy was sliding into the Great Recession.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.